Top 100 Project.
And action.
Welcome, movie lovers. The Top 100 Project takes a look back at the motion pictures on the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists. For those who haven't seen An American in Paris and are terrified of having it ruined, hit pause and come back later because we discuss this flick from end to end. I'm Ryan Ellis with my magnifique wife, Bev.
That's me.
The coming attractions trivia question for An American in Paris. You, Bev, said a few podcasts ago that American is a popular word in movie titles. How many AFI films have America, or American, in their title?
You know, I've actually thought about this, and I can't think of a single one.
Yes,
I know.
Yes, you can.
I can't. Well, okay, American in Paris. American in Paris. But I really can't think of another
one. There's only one more. I looked through very carefully. Yeah. American Graffiti.
Oh, of course. I just never think of that.
But when you said that at the time, I think you're right. A lot of movie titles play off of that notion, trying to catch on the Americans' desire to wave the flag. And yet when it comes to AFI films, only twice.
I think American Beauty was on the nominee list, wasn't it? Yeah, it would have been the
second
Best Picture.
Would have been the second list, so yeah.
Yeah.
And Citizen Kane was originally going to be called The American.
There you go, yeah.
So, but still, we're stretching here. Just two.
Yeah.
So the Top 100 Project's 41st movie, An American in Paris, a.k.a. Freedom Dancing, snagged the 68th position on AFI's 1998 Top 100 list between The Manchurian Candidate and Shane, but missed the cut in 2007, although it was among the 400 nominees. An American in Paris premiered on October 4th, 1951. Then MGM turned it loose on the Canadian Remembrance Day, November 11th. People lined up to see this one and made it a worldwide hit that autumn. Bev will skinny it up for us.
Gene Kelly plays Jerry Mulligan, an ex-GI and struggling American painter living in Paris. He falls instantly in love with Lise, played by Leslie Caron, unaware that a French friend of his is also in love with her. Much singing and dancing ensues.
Or in a French nutshell, starving artist's vivid imagination wins the love of woman he barely knows.
Yeah, that's the truth.
Just one of the weaknesses of this movie, that this guy, who's twice her age in reality, Gene Kelly, Leslie Caron, and in the storyline, he's not supposed to be exactly her same age, yet he convinces himself he loves her and he's got to be with her, but he barely knows anything about her.
Yeah, just pretty much sees her and falls in love, and we're never convinced that there's any reason to love her other than she's supposedly beautiful, even though the actress they cast to play her, well, no slouch.
She's okay looking.
She's okay looking. Like, she's not an uggo by any means, but she's not beautiful.
Yeah.
But that's like a major plot point, that she's so beautiful and irresistible that these two men, who are total hotties, by the way, both of them, they're total foxes, and they are just so madly in love with this woman who's mediocre and has no personality. There's not one real redeeming feature about her that's, I mean, they're lauded, you know, everybody says all these nice things about her, but when you actually see her character behaving, she does nothing. She does nothing interesting or particularly good or bad or anything. There's just not much to her.
And the guy who's her boyfriend, and then later in the film her fiancé, Henri Borel, is played by Georges Guterres. He does an okay job, but he doesn't really exactly stand out in this movie. I suppose the only other actor that's really worth mentioning too much, we'll do this right off the bat, well, two others, Oscar Levant and then Nina Foch. We'll get into their details later on, but Oscar Levant was, I guess he's a pretty famous name or well-known name. Actually, this is one of those movies, and we haven't had one of these in a little while, where apart from Gene Kelly, I don't know that the average person would have heard of any of these people. Maybe Leslie Caron.
You mean the average person now, or the average person when the movie came out?
No.
Yeah, yeah. I had never heard of any of these actors before.
And recently we've had plenty of movies where even somebody in the supporting cast, Marilyn Monroe and All About Eve, became a giant star and was just a small part of that film. Treasure of Sierra Madre had a tiny cast, so that's a different story maybe. But yeah, this is a rare one where it's just Gene Kelly. And all right, well, we've droned on. What do we think? What are your thoughts?
It's probably pretty obvious. There's things to like about this movie. There's the three fantasy sequences, which are probably the best part of the movie. And the last one in particular, the notoriously long, they call it the ballet sequence, though there's not that much ballet dancing in it. But the elaborate, long set piece at the end with that beautiful Gershwin song, it's great.
The song
really
is
good.
An American in Paris.
Yes, yeah.
Which was written to make this movie.
Yeah, exactly. It was written long before the movie came out. And it's a beautiful song. The set is absolutely breathtaking. The dancing isn't a bad thing you could say about it. Really, really well choreographed, well shot, well danced, like well performed by the dancers. Really fun. It was a great 18 minutes of film. 18 minutes long, you said it was? But to get there, God, the screenplay is atrocious. I cannot believe it won the Oscar for best screenplay, But shame on them. Like, to me, that is evidence of how corrupt or just how little credibility the Oscars have. It is a truly terrible script.
When a film gets that credibility and that buzz of being the big film that year, but it's not going to win Best Actor because Kelly wasn't nominated. And it might win Best Director. Vincent Minnelli was nominated. Mm-hmm. But it didn't really have anything else. None of the actors are recognized. So the screenplay kind of has to be if it's going to win Best Picture,
they're
too.
They're going to justify it.
Yeah.
Yeah, except that it's just terrible.
Oh, I agree. This movie is the first time, I've said this in quite a while, that this movie does not belong on the list. I've generally been very accepting of all the movies we've covered. 41, mm-hmm. and there's only a handful mm-hmm. that I've railed on
yeah.
the way that you have on a lot of them. And a lot of times I've liked a movie without thinking it was worthy of the list. Fantasia's the last movie I said that wasn't really worthy. That's the last color film we did. Hey, here we go. Finally a color movie after all
yeah,
these.
Yeah, it is nice to watch a color film.
Fantasia was 16 AFI movies ago. We've had black and white ever since. Yeah, so we finally yeah. break out with color. And this was full Technicolor. Yeah. I mentioned in the opening it was MGM that released it. This is the first movie they've released solely since Philadelphia Story, which was 14 AFI movies ago. And they were such a big part of our early doings. We've mentioned them because they've been a co-releaser of movies.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the first time they've done one in quite a while.
I read that there were rumors when American in Paris won the Oscar for Best Picture. MGM employed so many people, and MGM, the studio, wasn't really doing that well, even though this movie was a hit. And in order to like pump the studio up, they pressured all their employees to vote for American in Paris. And that's part of the reason why it won Best Picture over
Streetcar Named Desire.
Yeah,
African Queen, which we do in a few weeks, wasn't nominated. So I guess it's kind of pointless to make that argument. But people love that movie. It certainly stood the test of time better than an American in Paris has overall.
Mm-hmm.
And also A Place in the Sun, which we weren't huge fans of, but that won a ton of awards that year, too, and was beloved in that same year.
Hey, I didn't love Place in the Sun, but it was a better movie than American in Paris.
So the film was set in Paris, obviously, but it was shot at MGM in Hollywood. And I find that interesting because it's very artificial. And movies often were artificial mm-hmm. back in the day because of the days of the backlots. They still have some backlots now, generally. And, of course, green screen is what you see so often anymore, which is the ultimate of artificiality. However, being broke in Paris looks like the greatest time you'll ever have.
I know.
Like, right when you first see him wake up in the morning and he has this tiny little apartment. Of course, he's very dancey about it, but the way he puts his jerry bat away or whatever.
Like, I know what you call those things.
Pulleys that go up under the ceiling and pulls out his little table for his breakfast. Looks like a pretty nice life in 1951.
He's like a relentlessly happy dude. He's constantly smiling.
Yeah, Gene Kelly had sort of that grinning idiot mode of acting sometimes. I wouldn't say generally he did, but when he did, I always called it the Jack Carson school of grinning idiots. But yeah, Gene Kelly just did that sometime. And you'll see it in Singing in the Rain, which we do in a few weeks as well. Much better movie than this. Has aged so much better than this.
Mm-hmm.
We mentioned Oscar Levant. And he was going to play the Donald O'Connor role.
When you told me that, oh my God.
And he would have been okay in that, but we wouldn't have had the dancing scenes. I don't know if Levant even danced at all in this movie, did he? And he certainly couldn't have done the Make 'Em Laugh number. Flopping around and
not
jumping up beams and falling over.
Yeah.
And O'Connor's just so much more charming. Levant has a certain kind of charm. One other thing we have to say about Adam, the Oscar Levant character, is that he's the linchpin of this because he knows the two men, Henri and Jerry. So they meet and they all seem to be friends, but it's him that's the linchpin. And then later on in the film, in a kind of an unfunny scene, but I think it's supposed to be funny, he finds out that they're both in love with the same woman. And now what? And he's trying to smoke and drink at the same time or something.
Yeah, but he doesn't pull it off. I remember watching him, like, is he having a stroke?
Maybe
I don't
because
understand what he's even supposed to be doing.
Maybe because Levant was a non-actor.
He wasn't a very good actor. The little set piece that they do, the totally out there fantasy set piece, there's no setup or anything. It's so strange. But they just cut to him fantasizing about performing in an orchestra, and he plays that Gershwin song. And
he's everybody in the orchestra.
And he's everybody in the orchestra.
And he's in the audience.
But his performance on the piano is positively outstanding.
Unlike Dooley Wilson in Casablanca, he's really playing.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, and it's really a great sequence. It's really fun to watch, and it adds some value to him. But other than that, if they had to shoehorn that in, it was weird. I just don't know how he got cast in this role.
I think I read somewhere that Levant was friends with George Gershwin. George Gershwin had died long before, in 1938, so he wasn't any kind of influence on this film. Ira Gershwin lived a lot longer than this, so maybe he had some influence. But Levant may have been able to take advantage of that. Not that Levant was some stunt casting of, you know, like Francis Coppola's daughter in The Godfather Part 3. He was certainly capable. But, you know, that sequence you just talked about, I didn't think it was funny. I think it's supposed to be. Some of the reviews that I read talked about how it was one of the high points in the movie. It's playing off of something that Buster Keaton did in a movie where he is all the members of, I guess it was an orchestra as well.
Also, there was some visual elements that looked like they were taken straight from Fantasia. The screens with the silhouettes on them of the orchestra.
Yeah.
That reminded me very much of Fantasia. And in a way, that felt like a Fantasia type piece, because you just step away from any semblance of story just to show this for the sake
stop
of showing
the story
it.
And showing off.
Yeah. Yeah, which is how you could describe the big set piece at the end, the ballet, as they call it, at the end as well. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really serve any purpose whatsoever, plot-wise. I mean, it's fun to watch, but...
And even that's debatable.
Yeah, you don't like it, but this is where, like, I always forgive dancing more than you do. If you like watching dancing, then you would like watching
the
that
more
piece.
We see musicals in these films, I find that the ones that I can get into easily, and we talked about this before, I don't want to belabor this point, are the ones that are funny. Or Wizard of Oz actually is funny. I was about to change my mind on that point, but no, Wizard of Oz I find to be funny. Singing in the Rain is certainly funny.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember Cabaret. I've trashed it on our website, and I've mentioned a few times. I don't remember the hook of that film. We'll see it many months from now, well into next year. But the ones that we've seen that are musicals, I don't think I've liked them for that simple reason, that they stop the story, and it's almost like, you better make me care about things more. And that's, there you go. I didn't give my opinion on the beginning of this podcast in a more succinct way, and I'll do it right now, about the ballet, the famous ballet at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Who cares?
Yeah, there's no real stakes.
And like my nutshell says, he wins her back by dreaming about it.
I know, it's so poorly done.
And much like Swing Time, which you trashed, I didn't like it, but you just trashed Swing Time, as you should have. Everything works out. The two people that get left behind by the two main characters, Astaire and Rogers.
Practically thrilled.
It's fine. Go take my woman and go take my man. I understand.
When, for no reason whatsoever, Henri brings Lise back to Jerry. They've gone off to
presumably
the car.
She tells him, I love him. Okay.
But we never see that scene.
Yeah.
We don't know why he brings her back, but he does. He opens the door, the car door, to let her out, and he has this big grin on his face. Like, he's just so thrilled to give his girl
so remarkably bogus.
Yeah, it's so strange.
If you buy the love story, I guess that kind of thing makes you smile while watching it, but I don't buy the love story either, because they don't really have a ton of chemistry together. She dances well. She's definitely very talented.
Yeah, but her character isn't a dancer. That's the strangest thing. She's the actress herself probably got cast because she's such a beautiful dancer. And they have the fantasy scene early when Henri's describing her and she's doing all these different dances to, I guess, represent the different personality traits that she exhibits in his mind, but never once in the film. And then she dances in this fantasy sequence at the end. But when she's just being Lise, she never dances, not once.
It's almost like
except
she's
for, like, dance, slow dance with Jerry, but that's as close as she comes.
It's almost like she's not real, like she's Harvey the Rabbit or something.
She's just in their imagination.
I mean, she is in the movie, but...
That would have made it a more interesting
Is that
movie.
Sort of sexist, now that I think about it? These guys are telling people what she is, and they're describing how she's this perfect manic pixie dream girl. Well, maybe not manic, but pixie certainly fits, and a dream girl certainly fits.
Yeah.
But we never see evidence of it.
I guess it's sexist, but it's not like they have much personalities either, the guys.
It's true.
It's not like anybody is standing out for being particularly complex or deep or even likable, other than, you know, oh, you're good looking and you can dance and you have a relentless smile on your face. There's some weird stuff with Jerry, even with the Milo. I mean, here's a fault in the script. The whole story with Milo, with this woman who wants desperately to be his benefactor.
I mean, Nefosh, yeah.
But that story never goes anywhere. It never serves any purpose. And all it really does is seem to serve to make Jerry look just a little bit, at the very least, insensitive. At the worst, maybe a jerk. I don't think he does anything wrong in his relationship with her. He doesn't really cross any lines, but...
He's pretty unappreciative of what she tries to do for him, though. She pays for his okay paintings. And she tries to be his friend. She seems to want more, but she's not pushing it hard on him. It's not like, I'm going to pay for your paintings and you better service me, lover boy. And yet he just kind of
tosses her aside. But it's pretty clear she has a crush on him.
But he tosses her aside and she does nothing really to deserve to be tossed aside.
He'd have to be pretty oblivious not to see that she really likes him. And more than just a benefactor, you know?
Right.
And he blows her off. He hits on Lise right in front of her. He doesn't have to do any of that. They didn't have to put any of that in the script. It just kind of... is there to take up time and bore us in between fantasy sequences. I haven't said this in a while. I was bored.
Yeah.
This is really boring.
So was I. I was lubricated with a few drinks, though, so that probably helped me a little bit.
I should have done that.
Maybe you should have.
And while we're talking about, you know, Jerry and Lise and just characters and their motivations being a little hard to believe, why would Lise choose Jerry over Henri? Henri is, first of all, quite handsome, and he is a successful singer and dancer.
And he saw her first.
He saw her first.
They've had weeks, months, years, however long it's been.
Yeah, and he was very kind to her. And he can pronounce her name properly. Jerry, for some reason, just insists on calling her Lisa.
And he calls Henri Hank.
Oh, it drove me crazy. It's just like the most stereotypical, crude American thing to do. Call her Lise. Just call her Lise. That's her name. That's not hard. And for some reason, she falls in love with him instead of Henri. Like, I didn't really understand that. Henri's just straight up a better catch. Does she want to be a starving artist? Does she want to, like, squeeze into his teeny tiny closet apartment and live with him there?
When they realize they don't actually have anything to say to each other, it doesn't work out so well. Well, plus, I think this is the first painter on the AFI list. I don't know if we have a lot of artists anyway. If you want to call the jazz singer an artist, because he is, but not a visual artist.
This
must be the first one. We don't have a ton of people that paint, I don't believe.
I wonder sometimes if they just came up with that last dance sequence and then wrote the plot around it. They had this vision that they were going to make the whole thing look like a painting. And so they made Jerry's character a painter just so they could justify it.
He's such a good singer and a dancer. Of course, Gene Kelly was. But as a character,
I know.
He's lucky he had his tap shoes the day he was dancing with the kids.
And again later when he does that little dance with Henri first, wonderful, right?
Just happens to wear those tap shoes at all times. Yeah. And in that sequence with the kids, the grammatically incorrect I got rhythm, the kids kind of ruin it.
Yeah,
they're
the worst.
It's written that way, obviously. They've written it to be that I got, or they say, I got.
Yeah, but they don't time it right.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure I've heard the full version of that song sung properly by Gene Kelly or someone, and it is very catchy.
That's a standard. It was a song. It was a big song before the movie came out, wasn't it?
Well, if it was a Gershwin song, it had
to be. Yeah, of course, yeah.
That sequence that people seem to enjoy so much, I mean, you think about it, it's kind of butchered by the fact that they're butchering the song.
And there's really not that much to it. It comes up short. And I found this about all the sequences that were not the fantasy sequences, which were quite elaborate. It was the same with It's Wonderful. You know, it starts and it's building up and you feel like, all right, this is going to go somewhere. This is where it's going to get really good. And then it just kind of ends.
Well, also in that sequence, he's wearing white, pure white, as I recall. Later, he's wearing kind of pure black, making this movie even more on the nose about its motivations. There's no shades of gray in this one. Unlike a lot of the movies we've covered in the last couple of months, all through the 40s, there are shades of gray throughout. Mm-hmm. This one is, nope, this guy's pure one way and then he's pure the other way.
They even go to that black and white party where everybody in Paris mysteriously owns a black and white jester costume.
Thank God for that.
What a weird party that
was.
Coming
out of the war. Where their country was decimated.
Thank God there's no more rations on jester costumes.
So let's just get in the nitty gritty of the stars like we always do. Gene Kelly, big star, big name. He was also in Singing in the Rain. Of course, we're going to cover that in 3 weeks. He was only ever nominated for an Oscar once, and that was Anchors Away, where he dances with Jerry of Tom and Jerry fame, the cartoons. And he was known for musicals, of course, but he also did Inherit the Wind, the movie about the Scopes Monkey Trial with Spencer Tracy and Frederick March. This is a guy who stuck to what he knew very well.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I don't think he was a great actor. I think he was a really good dancer.
And you pointed out in the first scene that we were watching, he's an incredibly graceful man.
Yeah, oh, for sure. Mm-hmm. He and Astaire are two of the best athletes in the history of the movies.
But Fred Astaire, like we pointed out in Swing Time, he also had that weird grin mask on his face at all times that kind of...
That was an MGM thing, I guess. Maybe it's a musical slash MGM slash old Hollywood thing.
Yeah, it could also be like a Broadway thing. I mean, they do always tell dancers to smile. So that could be part of it.
This is almost like old Hollywood versus new Hollywood. Last week was Streetcar. This whole new way of doing things now with the method. We talked about such an incendiary kind of topic. And now here's one that's right back to the basics of I love the girl and let's tell the story. It's extremely simple.
Everything's clean. Everyone's poor, but they're happy. Mm-hmm. And nobody has very deep personalities.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to get complicated again a lot through the 50s. But this movie just throws it right out there
Hollywood.
With its... So Leslie Caron, her only AFI, not exactly a big name. This was her film debut. She was also in Gigi several years later, and Chocolat, which was not that long ago. And she's still alive in her 80s to this day.
No kidding. Yeah.
But then, because she was only 19, maybe that's not such a surprise.
Yeah, I guess so.
The supporting cast, Oscar Levant, was Adam Cook, also his only AFI. He was also in The Bandwagon with Fred Astaire a few years after this. That was a movie that I think was nominated for both AFI lists and very well could have made it. People really liked that one as a musical. That's Fred Astaire. Levant himself was primarily a pianist and a composer, as we said, not exactly the world's greatest actor. He only made a few more films after this and was done with acting in 1955.
Everybody was surely disappointed.
Nina Foch plays Milo Roberts. She was also in Spartacus, which we'll cover in a little while from now, and The Ten Commandments, which we won't. And she did a lot of guest spots on television. I mentioned the guy who played Henri, enough about him. And the director, Vincent Minnelli. Pretty famous name. We're going to get into another person with that name very soon. His only AFI film, but he also directed Father of the Bride, Elizabeth Taylor and Spencer Tracy, The Bad and the Beautiful, which I've talked to you many times and probably have mentioned on this podcast a few times. That was the movie that came out the year after this one, 1952.
Mm-hmm.
And he did Gigi with Leslie Caron. That also won some trophies, including Best Picture and Best Director. and a Christmas favorite for many people, Meet Me in St. Louis. And I believe that's where he met Judy Garland because they married and they had a kid. Maybe they had more than one, but they at least had one that we all know, Liza Minnelli, who will be in a movie we mentioned a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
Cabaret.
That's right.
Not exactly my favorite. And Liza Minnelli is frustrating in many ways. She's one of those people that diva. I hate that word. But she's definitely talented. And when we think of Arrested Development, the guest spot she had on there, she can be very funny too. You mentioned the inferior screenplay. That was written by Alan J. Lerner, who also wrote The Bandwagon, Gigi, and My Fair Lady. He won an Oscar for this, like you said, and two for Gigi.
Huh.
The movie was produced by another big name we haven't mentioned yet, Arthur Freed, who will also produce Singin' in the Rain. And he had an uncredited hand in Wizard of Oz, big part of MGM's musical company. He was a very influential, powerful player with them. Let's get back to Gershwin for a minute, because who can complain about this movie from that standpoint? Much like Fantasia.
Yeah, yeah.
I did say at the end of that one that as much as I thought it was not worthy of the AFI and maybe not even a great movie, at least you had the music and the visuals of that and the visuals of this, I guess. We recently saw Manhattan. That movie is just about all Gershwin. I think I might like this guy more than I ever would have realized. I guess I didn't know that that was really him. I heard the name when I saw Manhattan way back when. And I heard the name when I would have seen these other films, but...
The thing is, though, the music already existed before the movie came out, so it's not like it was introduced with the movie and then you can credit this movie
with introducing
us to all these beautiful songs. That's a good point, too. It's being introduced to you, and even just co-opting beautiful music that already exists still, you know, can positively add to a movie, and the songs are beautiful.
Well, Singin' in the Rain, I think every single song, or certainly the major ones, came from previous...
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, Arthur Freed songs.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah. Wow.
Singin' in the Rain had been... I think Singin' in the Rain was at least one musical many years before this, many years before...
Oh, how about that?
...the actual movie came out. And then the idea was, well, let's actually set a scene in the rain. Well, anyway, we're getting ahead of ourselves with a movie that we'll spend lots of time on because I do love that one. All right, so because this movie won some Oscars for texts, we better talk about the texts. The cinematographers, Alfred Gilkes and John Alton. Alton also worked on Father of the Bride with Minnelli and Elmer Gantry. And they shared an Oscar for this film for the color cinematography.
Mm-hmm.
The sets were headed by a name I mentioned to you way back when on the project, Cedric Gibbons. You see Cedric Gibbons and Douglas Shearer on, I think, every MGM production. Gibbons for the sets.
Oh, because they were the Shearer
for the
heads.
Yeah, so they maybe he didn't have anything to do with this in reality. I think he shared the Oscar with three other people. And we saw his name with Wizard of Oz, Philadelphia Stories, and we will see it for Singin' in the Rain. We did see it for Mutant on the Bounty way back when. The costumes, again, multiple people share the Oscar here. Ori Kelly, we've mentioned that name before. Irene Sharaf and those two won six Oscars between them, and they both did a slew of AFIers. And the music, Johnny Green, who did West Side Story, and Saul Chaplin, who also had a hand in West Side Story. And carrying on, want to soldier on through here, the awards and other AFI lists, which is actually quite extensive.
Ugh.
I guess we're in the minority on this one. People did love it then. They seem to love it now, the modern AFI voters. Six Oscars, Best Picture, Best Screenplay, Cinematography, the sets, the costumes, and the score, and the nominations for Best Director, Best Editing. Minnelli lost Best Director to George Stevens, and the editing, I think, also lost to Place in the Sun.
Mm-hmm.
Stevens did to Place in the Sun.
I have a question. I thought the Oscars wouldn't give an award for score if the music was lifted from another source.
I think then it would be like a screenplay adapted from a previous source. I think they had multiple categories. And this time frame, they also had multiple categories for cinematography, and they may have for the sets and costumes, too. But definitely for cinematography. They would have had a color cinematography Oscar and a black and white one. And so I believe that was the same with the score. I think they've actually cut down the Oscars in the last many decades.
So I remember that being a bit of a scandal because The Artist was nominated for Best Score, even though they lifted parts from the Vertigo score.
The Godfather score by Nino Rota was disqualified for an Oscar, even though it was nominated, and most likely would have won, but because he'd used it from, I think he worked with Fellini a lot, and I don't know if he even did that much recycling of his own music. But nope, you're out. And yet, like you're saying, American Paris, previous songs, and it wins for its music score. The other Oscar this movie took home was for Gene Kelly. Personally, the only time he ever won anything, he received a special one for this, quote, in appreciation of his versatility as an actor, singer, director, and dancer, and specifically for his brilliant achievements in the art of choreography on film. American Paris made the National Film Registry in 1993. Man, they really did love this movie 4 years in. There are a lot of movies that didn't get preserved until many years
later. Are we missing something?
And three other lists, all quite highly ranked. 39th on the Top 100 Passions.
Ugh, come on.
32nd on Top 100 Songs with A God Rhythm, badly sung by the children. And
butchered by those kids.
And this was 9th on the Top 25 Musicals.
Oh my God.
Well, at least it wasn't number one.
There's no way there's only 8 better musicals than American in Paris.
Yeah. Now, before we do the official promotion of next week's podcast, and I've already put this on the website, so a lot of our listeners know this, We're going to take a break. The Not 100 Project will be back for the fourth time. Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind is what we're going to cover. One of my absolute favorites, and certainly the most recent movie we've covered in any sort of way, apart from our now playing movies, I guess. So this is a nice lead in a way, because the ballet sequence in the movie is all in Gene Kelly's mind. In Eternal Sunshine, most of Kate Winslet's performance is in Jim Carrey's mind.
Yeah.
We didn't intend to have that kind of connection, and maybe it's a spurious connection at best. So we're going from this supposedly great romance to an awfully difficult, but another great romance next week.
Yes. And much more complex romance with real characters that have depth and complicated.
And a movie that our listeners have probably heard of.
There's that too.
But here's the best thing I can say about American in Paris. Certainly not worthy of being on this list. You agree?
Oh, yeah. Mary Poppins didn't make the list. Nope. How could Mary Poppins not make the list and this one does?
Yeah, yeah.
That's so strange to me.
Yeah. But here's the best thing I can say about it. We could finally clear it up the PVR after almost a year.
Yeah. Come on, I know. Just because you were like so badly didn't want to rent it or download it.
Why bother?
It,
we already had it. Why bother?
It's just been sitting there staring us in the
face. Thank you, Turner Classic Movies, for running it last February during their Oscar month.
The PVR, like it looks empty now. It looks like lonely without American in Paris sitting there.
Before we wrap, I want to talk about the influence just very briefly. We'll go backwards with this because this movie was influenced, and Gene Kelly at least went to the bosses at MGM and said, "Look at the red shoes. I want that kind of vibe." Now, have you ever seen or heard of The Red Shoes?
I've heard of it, but I've never seen it.
That's directed by Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger. They did a lot of movies together. Scorsese is a proponent of The Red Shoes. Mm-hmm. He talks about it a lot whenever he talks about old Hollywood and Technicolor. And that movie is about, I think it's just at the end. I haven't seen it in a long time, but I think the storyline at the very end is that this girl can't stop dancing, and if she does, she'll die. Her feet won't stop moving.
Mm-hmm.
But this film was influenced by that one. Mm-hmm. Because Gene Kelly said, hey, let's go for this kind of vibe and let's do it in our way, the American way.
I guess The Red Shoes wasn't eligible for the list because it wasn't an American film.
Then. Must have been English because Powell and Pressburger were English filmmakers.
Oh, yeah. Okay, there you go.
As far as an American in Paris influencing other movies, I guess MGM would have kept on making musicals because this one succeeded, but I can't think of a lot of direct influences.
Wasn't that big fantasy sequence at the end an actual risky, different thing that
they
did?
It was. I didn't care about it, but I'll give them that, yeah.
Yeah, whether they carried on doing stuff like that.
There's no dialogue for about 20 minutes at the end because the story isn't literally over at that point when that sequence ends. We see her, like you said, come back and Gene Kelly dance off with her or something. So yeah, there's probably a solid 20 minutes with no dialogue. 2001, A Space Odyssey does that. Obviously Fantasia did that.
Yeah.
But not many other musicals have a sequence that long without any kind of dialogue. Oh, one more thing I gotta mention. If your dad's listening, we can mention this now. He and I just very recently talked about how he and some of his friends, they have a movie club, they watch Singing in the Rain.
Yeah, that's right.
Promote that yet again. And in that, the one thing that he really didn't like at all, he wasn't as big a fan as some of the other people were, but the thing he liked the least is the thing I liked the least, and that is the sequence towards the end where Gene Kelly dances with Sid Charisse and other people too. But Debbie Reynolds, who was a good dancer but couldn't do that kind of dancing, that ballet and that choreography, they stop the story cold to do what they do in this movie. That's the worst part of the film.
Well, one of the things I said when we were watching American in Paris is the best parts of the film easily are the three fantasy sequences. Well, the first one's kind of short and a little bit throwaway.
I probably didn't agree with you on that, actually.
You don't think between Oscar Levant's piano stuff... Oh, you just don't like the 18-minute...
Like you said about Swing Time, if you want to see these dance sequences with Astaire and Rogers, go YouTube them and you'll get what you need out of this movie.
Yeah.
Well, because I didn't really care about these characters and didn't really care if they ended up together, then those sequences meant nothing.
Yeah, that's a good point. So it's not even like you can say if you just made the whole conceit of the movie that these characters persistently fantasize. If you have a conceit of a movie like that, then you can get really creative. And that is something that, in my opinion, American in Paris does well, is these incredibly creative set pieces that they made because they freed themselves by introducing them with the idea that they're fantasies. Yeah. And if you wanted to make a whole movie just with that... then you could do some really fun creative stuff, and maybe that's what they should have done if that's what they wanted to accomplish with this film. But if you're going to have something like Singing in the Rain, where everything is meant to kind of have a purpose and drive the plot along, and everything else seems to work with smoothly carrying everything along, and then you break for a fantasy scene, then it's going to seem out of place, and it's just, if it's not working as well as everything else, then why bother?
And it's, to a certain point, just showing off. We talked about In a Night at the Opera, which you really didn't like at all, and I certainly liked more than you. One of the best parts of that movie is when Harpo and Chico both stop the movie cold to show off playing the piano and the harp.
And I enjoyed that part.
Right. It has nothing to do with the movie, really, but it's just they're showing off. Well, that's what Levant is doing in his sequence, and that's what Gene Kelly's doing with all the ballet dancers in that sequence.
I would have been okay with a movie that was just like that, but in the same way that I enjoyed Fantasia for what it was, and you didn't. I think that part of that is a taste thing.
And my taste is not to like this film. All right, well, we said this a few minutes ago. Next week, we take a break from the Top 100 Project to review a movie in the Not 100 Project series. It's one of my absolute favorites of the century so far, and appropriately for Valentine's Day, it's a quirky, weird, passionate Valentine to troubled love. Jim Carrey and Kate Winslet in Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, one of the most unusual titles of all time. Talk about standing out, it's a great title, though.
Yeah, I love this movie. I haven't seen it in a really long time, though. I remember I watched it a few times when it came out. For some reason, I've never gone back to it, so I'm really looking forward to watching it with some fresh eyes.
So the coming attractions trivia for Eternal Sunshine. Between Jim Carrey and Kate Winslet, who had more of the 400 nominated Top 100 films? Jim Carrey was acting long before Kate Winslet. Did he have more than her, though?
That's a really
good question. Also been in better movies.
Yeah.
All right.
So we'll have the answer for that one in next week's podcast for Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. In the meantime, if you would like trivia about American in Paris, along with all the other movies we've covered in the podcast, please go to our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. And you could also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. What do you think of American in Paris? Would you like to defend it to us? Please send us an email. We'd love to hear everyone's thoughts. top100projectpodcast@gmail.com.
I got
rhythm.
Who cares?
And cut.